From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, treating the sick and wounded in Rwanda, we talk with Dr. John Sundin. He recently returned from Kigali, where he helped set up the Red Cross Field Hospital. He was the hospital's only surgeon, and for a while, that was the only hospital in the city. Also, the coach of champions, we talk with Bella Caroli, the gymnastics coach who trained Romania's Nadia Comăneci and the U.S.'s Mary Lou Retton. Caroli defected from Romania to the U.S. in 1981. Also, commentator Dagoberto Gilb reflects on Little League baseball and poverty in his Texas town. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Israel's prime minister says peace is the desire of his people. Yitzhak Rabin joined Jordan's King Hussein at a joint meeting of Congress today. Both leaders told the lawmakers of their efforts toward a new peace between their countries. Israel and Jordan have formally ended 46 years of hostilities, and both are now working toward a peace agreement. The Pentagon admits that its relief operation in Rwanda has a lot still to be accomplished. UPI's Pi Chamberlain has this report.
The Pentagon says it can now supply water to less than one-tenth of the refugee population, many of whom are dying of thirst and cholera for lack of water. Aid Coordinator General Sheehan says the medical facilities set up are crude, used, for example, for
people who have wounds as a result of machete cuts, stitch them up, fix them up, and then allow them, hopefully, to get back on the road.
I don't mean to push this too far. What I meant was that it just seems like such a drop in the bucket with literally thousands and thousands of people are dying.
That's absolutely correct. But it's a start.
He says the effort will grow, but a problem is the camps should not be so attractive that people stay instead of going back home. Pi Chamberlain, Washington.
The Bosnian Serbs say they will close the one route into Sarajevo that has carried commercial and civilian traffic for the last 4 months. A United Nations spokeswoman says the action will cut off the main source of food for the Bosnian capital. The cutoff starts tomorrow, and it will end the first sustained period of normalcy since the bombardment and siege of Sarajevo started in April 1992. Negotiators from the House and Senate have resumed work on a compromise crime bill. A number of contentious issues remain to be worked out. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
It's been 6 weeks since the last time members of the House-Senate Conference Committee met on the crime bill. One of the reasons for the delay is Conference Chairman Jack Brooks' adamant opposition to a ban on 19 assault weapons. Brooks, a House Democrat from Texas, has vowed to fight the ban, which is included in the Senate-passed crime bill, but in a separate House bill. Gun ban supporters are optimistic they have the votes to make the assault weapons ban part of the final crime bill. Another major controversy centers around a part of the House bill that allows statistics to be used to determine if racial bias is a factor in death sentencing. Republicans in the Senate have threatened to filibuster the bill if it contains that provision, and it's likely to be dropped. This is Brian Naylor at the Capitol.
Authorities in Argentina say 95 people are now known dead from last week's bomb blast outside a Jewish community center in Buenos Aires. City officials say 10 more corpses are still in the rubble. Rescue crews are expected to finish their grisly work tonight. Israeli military officials working in the investigation say the blast came from a car bomb in front of the former seven-story building. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 4.5 points at 3,737. This is NPR. Martin Marietta has reportedly been awarded a multi-billion-dollar Pentagon contract to build new spy satellites. NPR's Greg Peppers reports.
Today's Washington Post reports that the $2 billion contract awarded to Martin Marietta is expected to generate hundreds of jobs at the company's plant in Denver over the next decade. The go-ahead for building the satellites was reportedly given by the National Reconnaissance Office. Martin Marietta's competitor, TRW, originally won the contract to build what are called synthetic aperture radar satellites, but the Lockheed Corporation and Marietta protested the decision, saying the government violated its own procedures in awarding the work. Earlier this year, the General Accounting Office ruled that the contract should be rebid. The contract decision is bad news for Northern and Southern California, where Lockheed and TRW have their plants. The Post says the next-generation satellite system is designed, among other things, to keep track of other nations' planes, ships, and equipment on the ground, both by snapping pictures and by eavesdropping on electronic communications. I'm Greg Peppers in Washington.
A fast-moving wildfire in Oregon has forced vacationers to evacuate a popular resort. Some 200 people left the Katana Village on the Warm Springs Indian Reservation for the main lodge. Both highways out of the resort are closed. The fire has scorched at least 3,000 acres. It began when a barn caught fire. Meanwhile, fire crews are trying to snuff some 150 fires in central and northern Idaho. They're afraid a new storm will fan the flames and start new blazes. Some Georgia flood victims are finally moving out of shelters and into emergency housing. The 10 families were the first to pick up keys to temporary federal housing in Albany, Georgia. The flooding destroyed more than 9,000 homes and apartments in the city when it began raining several weeks ago. Nearly 800 people are still living in Red Cross shelters. The federal government plans to bring in about 400 more mobile homes to southern Georgia. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A cholera epidemic has killed over 14,000 Rwandan refugees. The refugees need clean water, latrines, medicine, and more doctors. My guest, Dr. John Sundin, is an American surgeon who recently returned from Rwanda. He worked at a Red Cross hospital in Kigali from mid-April through the end of June. For much of that time, this hospital was the only medical facility in the city, and Sundin was the city's only surgeon. While he was there, he used a satellite fax machine to send letters to friends at Yale, where he had worked the year before as an instructor. Some of those letters have just been published in Harper's Magazine. We spoke with him earlier today from Connecticut about his experiences treating the victims of civil war. But first, we talked about the cholera epidemic and what created it.
It's a problem with water and sanitation. In India, Bangladesh, and the Far East, it occurs regularly. It's endemically. People get it in a low frequency all the time. Epidemics occur when you get too many people in one place and the water gets contaminated, there are inadequate sewage facilities, and you essentially contaminate the water with cholera, the bacteria, and it spreads like wildfire.
Why does it kill so quickly?
Cholera affects the intestine. It doesn't affect the rest of the body. And it causes, the incubation period is about 3 to 6 days. And then you have a sudden onset of profuse watery diarrhea. It can be up to 10 liters a day of diarrhea. You end up getting dehydrated. You go into circulatory collapse, and you can die within 10 to 12 hours. This is why it strikes, still to this day, strikes terror in people's minds. This is the name, the word cholera, because back in the old days, British troops in India, the mortality was 70 to 80%, and that's why it's dreaded even to this day.
But probably if you have water and antibiotics, it's very easy to treat.
If it's treated, the mortality is only 1%. You need the patients need to be rehydrated and treated with antibiotics. So it's easily treatable, but it has to be nipped in the bud early on because it's very contagious. And as is evident in this refugee camp in Goma, it spreads like wildfire and people die very rapidly.
So if you have thousands and thousands of people with terrible diarrhea because they have cholera, that's just going to make the situation much worse because there's no sanitation facilities.
Right, and so the thrust now, the first thing is to establish clean water. And this is clean water for a million people. A person on the average needs 5 liters a day for sort of cooking, and drinking. That's 5 million gallons of water a day. And Goma's at the base of a volcano. It's a volcanic rock. It's not as if you can go just dig some wells and dig latrines. It's a logistical nightmare there.
Dr. Sundin, you went to Rwanda at the end of April. What inspired you to go?
I had been in Sri Lanka for 4 months in the fall with Doctors Without Borders in the north, outside of Jaffna, where the Tamil Tigers and the Sinhalese have been in a civil conflict for the last 10 years. So I'd basically taken this year off to do overseas work. So I had that. I had had that experience in Sri Lanka, and actually, I was in the beginning of April. I was in Hawaii interviewing for a regular job in a private practice, and I was in Honolulu looking at the television, and I saw Kigali shots that were coming out at that time, right after the plane crash was April 6th, and the carnage started, and the photos were coming out, and I called Paris and asked them if they needed some help, and I was on a plane second week in April and on my way to Kigali.
Would you describe the hospital that you worked out of in Kigali?
It was set up from scratch, April 12th, a Red Cross convoy, and in conjunction with Doctors Without Borders, drove in from Burundi with large trucks and surgical team and nurses to set up this hospital in what was before a Catholic girls' school run by nuns.
And you were the only surgeon?
For most of the time, I was the only surgeon, and we were the only hospital operating in Kigali.
Now, that civil war was fought with machetes and clubs and spears. What kinds of injuries did you have to treat?
Early on, we were seeing quite a few machete wounds, and these are machete wounds to the head and the neck and the arms and legs. And then they did not spare the women and children. We had quite a few children that had been attacked and would present with these wounds.
Did you know how to treat wounds like that? Had you ever seen anything like it before?
I had seen bad wounds in Sri Lanka, but those mostly were mortars and bullets. Nobody that I know has seen machete wounds of this type, especially that to see a child come in with machete wounds to the head and the neck, or somebody to come in with their hand amputated by a machete, this is something you don't see much anywhere.
How much did you understand the conflict, and how much was that relevant to the work that you were doing?
We had to be aware of the conflict, the local politics, because when I first got there were two hospitals. The one hospital was more the military hospital and more the Hutu hospital, and we were receiving more of the Tutsi patients. But then the other hospital was mortared, shut down, and we were getting everybody. We were getting the Tutsis, the Hutus, the military, the Interahamwe, the militia, and we had to be sensitive to the local politics and talking with them and being cognizant of what was going on, because here we were 2 miles from the front of this war, right in between the combatants, and having these militia around too, who had no sense of order or discipline, and so it was being neutral in a situation like that. You have to know what's going on to survive.
In one of your letters, you described the day that members of the Hutu militia, who you say killed Tutsis for sport, showed up at the hospital with clubs and spikes. What did they want from you?
Well, the day before was a typical day that we had received too many wounded and we were overwhelmed. We had one operating room and we were able to do maybe 15 to 20 cases a day. And that's if we weren't getting mortared. And it was during that time that for 3 days the mortar fire was so heavy that we weren't able to do any operating, and we spent most of our time in the concrete shelter because it was just too dangerous to venture out. And at the same time, every day 50 to 100 people are arriving with these significant wounds, and And I remember the man, he arrived, and he was one of the many, many, many that we were watching, trying to get to, didn't have the time, didn't have the safety, and he died before we had a chance to operate on him. And he was one of the many that didn't make it because of that. And it happens that he had some friends in the militia that came the next day looking for their friend, and they entered this Red Cross hospital with their machine guns, with their arms, with their machetes, threatening to murder us. And
to murder you because you'd let their friend die?
Yes, there were accusations that we favored the Tutsis over the Hutus and this and that, when in fact we didn't. We treated everybody the same. But it's hard to reason with these people, and which we didn't reason. We hid, and fortunately the UN came by, because they would come by to pick up some bandages every once in a while, and they left, but they said they would be back. So it was a very tense situation there. It was tense enough, but having to operate, thinking that somebody's going to come in and shoot you for something that you we were trying to do your best at. So it was a tense time for us all.
Where did you hide?
Well, when they were in the hospital, we were all up in, we had our rooms in the dormitory, and we had been eating lunch at the time, and we were hiding in closets, and because we all had walkie-talkies, so we heard that they were in the hospital. Armed people were in the hospital, and they actually made some of the Red Cross workers go up and dig up his body, because we had our own graveyard in the compound. So they made us dig, not me, but somebody else went up there, and they saw that his body had no scar on it, that he hadn't been operated on. And then they said that he had 1 million Rwandese francs in his shoes, which, you know, I don't know whether he did or not. But where was the money? They wanted the money. It wasn't so much concern for their friend. They were trying to extort us for money.
Uh-huh. Now, you had good reason to be afraid. There were about 150 people who were massacred at a hospital run by Doctors Without Borders in Rwanda.
And down in Butare. That's why we were all very aware of the fact that these guys had a history. They had a bad attitude, and we were sensibly fearful for our lives and the patients' lives.
My guest is Dr. John Sundin. From mid-April through the end of June, he was the surgeon at the Red Cross Hospital in Kigali. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest, Dr. John Sundin, spent 2.5 months as a Red Cross surgeon in Rwanda. You got sick for a while when you were working in Kigali. What did you have? Do you know?
I don't know, because we didn't have a laboratory there. We had no X-rays, no blood for transfusion most of the time. I had a fever. I had to assume that it was malaria, although malaria wasn't that common in Kigali because it's a high elevation, but it did occur. It could have been some other things, but you don't want to sit on malaria too long because you can die from it. So I ended up taking the treatment for malaria under the assumption that it was, and felt better in a couple of days. So whatever it was, I got better. And was able to go to work in a day or so.
There was a nurse there who was trying to convince you to operate on patients who were coming to the hospital in spite of the fact that you had like 103 temperature. And you decided not to. It must be very hard to make a decision like that unless, I suppose, probably you were just feeling physically incapable of doing a good job anyways.
Well, limits had to be set. And after that incident or that decision, because we met as a group and we discussed this as a team, that we had as a team to set limits because we were getting too many patients to take care of. You have to understand, this was a 500 bed hospital with just stretchers, no beds. There was no place to transfer patients. There was no other team to call in. We had no blood. We couldn't do everything for everybody. So we had to, it was a triage, which in medicine, you choose the patients that have the best chance of survival and work on them. And choices have to be made. And I was in a position as the surgeon to make those choices. And as I said to her, that I'll take the hit, I'll take the responsibility, but we can't do everything for everybody. And that was difficult for the whole team because it was personally, ethically, emotionally, professionally very difficult to have patients dying who you could easily save if you had enough time, or staff, but we couldn't. So we lost a lot and we saved a few, but that came up in discussion. And it was I brought it up in discussion because it was something that I had to deal with also. Here I am, 103 fever, and this man needs an operation, and I have to say no, because I had to set those limits on my own resources and the team's resources, and that was difficult.
It must be hard because you're watching somebody die right now, thinking that in the long run this is what you have to do to preserve your ability to take care of the people tomorrow and the next day.
Right, and that's a decision that we a few cases we did at night. A few nights we operated until 3 or 4 in the morning. But then the next day there wasn't another team. And then the next morning, 50 or 100 other people would arrive. So after after a couple of those nights, I set the limit that no, we do not operate at night. We're the only team. We have our own physical and psychological health to consider. And we weren't going to do anybody any good if we operated 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and collapsed and had to be shipped out. So after a time, we did not operate at night, and limits were set, and that's how we coped with the situation.
As you have to set these really difficult limits, do you find that you have to harden yourself toward the people who you're seeing because you have to set those limits, because you have to reconcile to yourself to the fact that you're going to lose people?
That's the triage in a war situation, and journalists were coming through every other day because we were on the tour of Kigali. So the UN would bring by a photojournalist, the video, and the print journalist. And they would see, yes, we would have, there would be patients everywhere, wounded everywhere. And over in the corner, there'd be a 5 or 6 year old child who had received a bullet to the head with exposed brain, and over in the corner receiving no care, because that child has a mortality of 95%. So they would focus on the emotional component of this child, and they would ask us about them. But we were busy trying to save the other ones that maybe had a traumatic amputation of the leg or a bullet to the belly or somebody that had the chance of being saved. So they would tend to read us maybe as being unemotional and hardened, but that's the professional detachment that we had to maintain of not focusing on who we couldn't save, but focusing on who we could save. And in that context, it's totally different than working in any hospital that's not in a war zone.
What kind of practice are you returning to?
Well, right now I'm unemployed. So I'm in between and looking for a type of surgical practice which would allow me some flexibility to do this every year or two. That's difficult to find, especially if you enter in on a private practice. It's hard to tell your partner that you're going to be out of town for 3 months. So I'm going to be looking for some sort of position that allows me some flexibility to do that.
Does working in a war situation change your impressions of American medicine? Does it make you see it any differently?
Well, as a lot of people ask me why I did this or why I do this, and one of the answers I've come up with, which rings true to me, is that in a lot of ways, I'd rather work for the Red Cross or Doctors Without Borders for very little money overseas in a civil strife zone where I'm getting shot at, where the need is phenomenal and people are really appreciative, than to set up practice in this country with the pernicious regulatory system and the paranoia about litigation and to be able to go overseas. It's unfortunate that doctors and nurses sometimes have to go overseas to practice the kind of medicine that they really love to do, as opposed to trying to do that in this country with all the frustrations.
So how are you doing now? I'm sure when you were actually in Kigali at the hospital that you just keep working and you maybe try not to think very much. And then you come home and you have a chance to really reflect on the experience. How's your health? How's your emotional state?
Well, it's been good to talk about it to the radio and also was part of my therapy while I was there was to write about it, to get it out. And we all saw the stress doctor in Geneva because they recognize now that expatriates or people that work in civil strife zones have psychological consequences of that stressful situation. So people have asked me whether I've been having any nightmares and my sleep cycle is very messed up. And the fact is, I don't think I'm having any dreams yet. I'm not even any nightmares. So I don't think I will, because although never say never, I think I'm processing this in my own fashion, as we all have to process it. And it will take some time to work it out.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
All right. It was good talking with you, Terry.
Dr. John Sundin worked as a Red Cross surgeon in Kigali from mid-April to the end of June. His letters home are published in the August issue of Harper's Magazine. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Romania's Nadia Comăneci was the first Olympic gymnast to score a perfect 10. She did it under the guidance of her coach, Bella Caroli, who discovered her when she was 6. Coming up, we talk with Caroli, one of the most influential and controversial coaches in gymnastics. He defected from Romania to the United States in 1981. Also, the story of a Little League baseball team that can only get to first base. Commentator Dagoberto Gilb tells us what it's like for his son to play on a team in a poor neighborhood in Texas. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Jordan's King Hussein and Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin have strengthened their pledge of a new Mideast peace today. They spoke before a joint meeting of Congress. Both said they want their peoples to live as neighbors and friends. Premier Rabin says both countries are close geographically and share many things.
Only a 70-minute journey separates these cities, Jerusalem and Amman. And 46 years. And just as we have been enemies, so can we good and friendly neighbors.
King Hussein drew a standing ovation when he declared the state of war between Israel and Jordan is over, but he also used his speech to raise the thorny issue of Jerusalem.
My religious faith demands that sovereignty over the holy places in Jerusalem reside with God and God alone. Dialogue between the faiths should be strengthened. Religious sovereignty should be accorded to all believers of the three Abrahamic faiths in accordance with their religions. In this way, Jerusalem will become the symbol of peace and its embodiment.
The two leaders are now holding a press conference with President Clinton. Russia's defense minister is talking in Belgrade today with Bosnian Serb leaders. The Serbs have rejected the latest international Bosnian peace plan, and the Russian official is discussing the Serbs' next step, the BBC's Kathy Jenkins reports.
The Russian defense minister's mission is to try to get the Bosnian Serbs to change their stance. The Bosnian Serb leader, Radovan Karadzic, still hopes that divisions within the international community will spare the Serbs any punitive measures. There are certainly divisions over how punitive steps would be enforced. The United Nations Secretary General, Boutros Boutros-Ghali, has suggested that it shouldn't be a task for the UN peacekeepers. The UN contingent, he says, would be too small to monitor a peace agreement and not equipped to enforce tougher measures. UN commanders on the ground have voiced similar views, and countries which contribute troops to the UN force, notably France, have repeatedly warned that they could pull their soldiers out.
Kathy Jenkins reporting. Meanwhile, a UN spokeswoman says the Bosnian Serbs plan to close the only road into Sarajevo tomorrow. It's the main food supply route, and commercial and civilian traffic has used it for the last 4 months. The Serbs have also resumed bombing the eastern Bosnian town of Garajda. They're under threat of NATO airstrikes there, but no NATO action has been taken. On Wall Street, stocks closed lower today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost more than 6 points to close at 3,735. Declines led advances in heavy trading. This is NPR. The government today promised lifetime monitoring for former workers and subcontractors at the Fairnald Uranium Processing Plant near Cincinnati. Margaret Uveling of member station WNKU reports.
Former workers at the federally funded uranium processing plant filed a lawsuit in 1990 accusing the former contractor at the plant, National Lead of Ohio, of failing to inform workers they were exposed to dangerous radiation and contamination. The plaintiffs in the $500 million lawsuit say they now suffer emotional distress from the fear of getting cancer. The settlement guarantees lifetime monitoring for about 4,500 people who worked at the plant from 1951 through 1985. The program is valued at $20 million, but the cost depends on how many people participate and for how long. The settlement also establishes a court-appointed independent panel to determine whether former Fairnald workers should be considered for state workers' compensation. The Energy Department could use the proposed settlement as a model for at least six similar lawsuits around the country. For National Public Radio, I'm Margaret Ueberling.
U.S. Army specialists say the first clean water systems for Rwandan refugees should be up and running very soon. They hope to stop the spread of cholera and other diseases that have killed at least 14,000 refugees in filthy camps in Zaire. But U.S. soldiers say their effort is just a drop in the bucket. The estimated 1.2 million refugees consume millions of gallons of bad water every day. The water machines can supply only 24,000 gallons of water each day. A private business research group says consumers are less optimistic about the economy. The Conference Board's report on consumer confidence for July slipped slightly from June, but it's still at a high level. The group says its latest survey shows the economy is growing steadily, but at a moderate pace. The Conference Board has added that most Americans are satisfied with current conditions. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Bella Karoly has coached two of the world's most famous gymnasts, Nadia Comaneci and Mary Lou Retton. 27 of his students have gone on to the Olympics. Seven of them have become Olympic champions. Karoly was the coach of Romania's Olympic gymnastics team, but communist politics did him in, and in 1981, he and his wife defected to the United States. After getting his bearings and learning English, he went on to coach the U.S. Olympic team. He now runs gymnastics summer camps in Houston and is training Kim Zmaskal, the first American world champion gymnast, for her return to competitive gymnastics. Karoly tells his life story in his new memoir, Feel No Fear, The Power, Passion, and Politics of a Life in Gymnastics. He says that when he coached in Romania, he and his team were used politically by the dictatorship.
As being well known and had been a tremendous political tool, sports all been used by the former socialist countries, one of the great propaganda tools. They made a tremendous propaganda through their leading athletes, and basically that had the only thing what they could show positively to the world, what they're producing. And sure, they did not hesitate, and they had no embarrassment to use the names and the performance of those young athletes as a result of the political system, as a creation of the communism, of the socialism. And this tool was really, really used on outside very politely, very, very propaganda-wise, but inside forcefully, forcing the athletes, forcing the related people, the ones who were involved in preparation of those young athletes, to line up and really, really, really follow the direction what the communist leaders were lining up in front of them.
So what are some of the things you were expected to say or do to follow the line of the Communist Party in Romania?
Of course, nobody ever could mention the athletes are not doing it because the self-motivating reasons. The athletes always been pictured a very dedicated, willing to put on the line not just their physical effort but even their life in order to serve the country. They're doing it from in the free reasons, and of course, you know, all these positive propaganda or slogans which were very, very used on that time.
So you must have really resented that your hard work and the hard work of the athletes was showed within Romania to be just things you were doing to support the communist system.
Well, I rejected most of the things, but I could not speak up because speaking up, that would mean immediate direct persecution and jailed or any harsher punishment, which they practically been doing it all along. A direct conflict was created during the 1980 Moscow Olympic Games when I spoke up at that time against the Soviets, the ones who did totally denaturated that particular Olympic Games through the Western countries boycott, and among the Western countries, of course, United States was one of them who did not show up in 1980 Olympic Games. Soviets been dominating and Soviets been dictating all the results and all the outcome of the results. So I spoke out and we created a scene which later considered as a tremendous anti-communist action, an anti-communist Olympic Games action. So I was accused about that, and from that point, my life was put under the very, very keen watch of the government.
So were the secret police on you after that?
Well, secret police has always been on anybody who was visible at that time in socialist countries, but the secret police watch, of course, doubled after that. And during a American propaganda and also money-making tour, a 20-city exhibition tour, which came up in in January, February 1981, I was followed by secret police in all my steps. And also I was actually victim of a setup which was combined government and secret police. And through that setup, I had no choice to return. I had to make the decision here in the United States without any kind of pre-preparation of my defection to make that crucial and dramatic move.
Were you able to tell the girls on your team that you wouldn't be seeing them again?
It was almost impossible to come out and talk to them freely about my intention. I did not want that, first of all, to jeopardize their welfare. I then wanted to make them accomplice of my decision. But I get them together, and I talk to them briefly about how they're supposed to take their life and what is the reason they got to the point they are respected and well-known athletes in the world. And that was only hard work, dedication, and that's what I wanted to make sure they will never forget in their life. Only through hard work and dedication you can achieve something precious.
My guest is gymnastics coach Bella Caroli. He defected from Romania to the U.S. in 1981. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Back with gymnastics coach Bella Caroli. His new memoir is called Feel No Fear. Let me ask you about probably the most famous gymnast who you ever coached, Nadia Comaneci. How did you first meet her? How did she first start to work with you? And how old was she? How much did she weigh then?
Well. Nadia is a beautiful story. Probably is one of the brightest athletic stories in the gymnastic history. We've been screening the young athletes in kindergarten. So I'm personally been going with hundreds and hundreds of kindergarten, watching the kids and trying to find out the most talented ones. And through this screening process, I found her in one elementary school, which was she was a first grader. And pick her up through this process and direct her to the gym. That's how we started out. Then 14 or 15 years in continuous coach and athlete relation. Sure, she became one of the most brightest, most spectacular young athlete of the times.
Now, what were some of the things that you did in coaching her and trying to shape not only her physical approach to gymnastics, but her attitude toward the sport?
The permanent interrelation was beautiful on the first 10 years of our coaching relation, athlete and coach. Unfortunately, after 1976, this relation got altered by the government stepping into our life. Both Nadia and myself, we've been placed very highly as the social ranking. The government gave us high orders and high visibility on our own country, but at the same time, they demanded to be with them, to follow their direction, to speak what they wanted to hear. And with this one, of course, both of us lives were pretty much disturbed through this permanent process. Nadia was a young athlete and a young child, to say, at that time, because we're talking about 1977, 1978, when she still was a teenager and suddenly placed in such a high visibility position in Romania, and being placed right next to the president and following the president in many, many different functions, and the high visibility visits of foreign dignitaries just totally disturbed her life and, of course, disturbed her athletic preparation. That was a tremendous downfall at that time of her, of course, which came out with a with a dramatic downfall on her athletic abilities and athletic performances. Maybe some of the people remembers how Nadia disappeared in 1978 and wasn't even capable to line up on her national championship. Then being in such a big trouble, she asked me, Bella, help me to get back once again. Then I stepped back in 1978 again on her line and built her up for another Olympic Games, which was probably one of the most brilliant, most spectacular performance she ever had in 1980 in Moscow, during the Moscow Olympic Games.
After she'd gotten back into shape and was performing excellently again, in 1979 she was going to compete in the World Championship, which was being held in Texas, but she hurt her hand right before the competition. And as the competition was about to start, her hand was swollen and numb, and there was blood seeping through the bandage. What did you advise her to do?
This was a dramatic moment. One of the things which an ordinary athlete and an ordinary person cannot handle. And even today, thinking back, I have goosebumps recalling those dramatic moments when we find it out she is injured, because nobody knew about it. Our delegation leader, who was the president at that time of the Romanian Federation, took her in that particular morning, which was the day of the optional competition, a team competition, took her to the hospital where a surgery was performed in a infected wrist, which usually we handled on our own homemade remedies and never been subject of dropping out of the competition. But the zealous fellow who was wanted to have this authority to take her to the hospital did it. And of course, whenever you're getting in the hands of the doctor, they're going to do what they think is needed to be done. And they considered it needed to be done a surgery. So they did perform a surgery on her wrist.
So you were really surprised to find out the day of the competition that Nadia had had hand surgery. So she really wasn't fit to compete. Yet you sent her in anyways. What came over you?
The drama of the moment was multiple. First of all, Nadia's personal drama, the one who went through the surgery, that went through to this tremendous moment to realize she cannot compete. But second of all, we had another drama going on, and that was the athletic rivalry between the Romanians and the Soviets, the ones who been celebrating Nadia's injury.
Oh, they were really glad. The Soviets were really glad she was injured. Now they stood a better chance of winning.
Absolutely, because you know that she was Nadia was still Nadia, the Olympic champion and the most visible athlete of those times, and the drama of our young remaining athletes, the ones who suddenly completely got handicapped because not just their star, but one performing athlete was missing from the team. You cannot replace the athletes as long they already perform on the compulsory part of the competition. So we not just been discovered, but we lost our best competitor for the rest of the competition, which was coming up. So that's why NMA decided to use her, even though I knew she could not do in uneven parallel bars, to have her go up, touch the bar, and come down. The score was 1 point. One single point. But that 1 point gave her a chance to be present to the next event. If you skip first event, you are eliminated from the competition.
Now,
and I did not know at that time, really. I really didn't know at that time how much this moment gonna count later on. I did not know we ever even gonna use her at all or just gonna be a formality. But later on became such a dramatic moment which turned the whole competition and generated a ultimate result, what the Romanian teams managed finally to do, to won the very first team world championships against the Soviets.
When you sent Nadia in to actually compete, what did you advise her to do, to just work on one hand?
The moment came at the time when after the second event, which was the beam event, our last competitor, our fifth girl, did not perform to the performance what we expected from her. She had a fall. In this very moment, even though after an even parallel bar, which was first event, we still managed to lead the competition. After her fault, which was the very last between the five remaining athletes, our chances that moment were completely gone to be even close anymore to the Soviets. So that was the moment Nadia, as the sixth and last competitor, I asked her to go up and try to do a performance for herself, for her teammates, for me, and for anybody who loves her. And she looked at me. She did not say a word. She did not ask questions. She stood up from the bench. She walked up to the beam, and she did perform her incredible and unforgettable beam routine, which is going to stand up everywhere of anybody's mind who was at that time on that arena. And on the end of that routine, which actually was performed by one hand, she managed to receive the highest score of the whole competition, a 9.95, only 0.005 from a perfection, which plays back the Romanian team, gave the wing, and gave the opportunity to become, after two events, the very first time world champions in team competitions in front of the Soviets.
Have you ever had any regrets about defecting?
I did not started out my American life trying to whine or trying to even regret anything from the past. I had no choice. I had not the second choice to do it, and as long that was the reality, the only thing what I was looking for, it is to work to create my own choice and my own chances to survive. And through that one, I had absolutely no regrets on anything what happened. Of course, wasn't a red carpet rolled out from my in front of me at the time when we came. I worked extremely hard, and even I was removed from gymnastic community and even from my own profession, working in the docks, loading and loading ship, cleaning restaurants, which is part of probably at the very beginning American life for any kind of immigrant who comes in. But I believe that just make you stronger and make you realize nothing is in America, and just like nothing in the world is coming for free. There is no free lunch out, and if you want to get something, you better work for it.
Bella Caroli's new memoir is called Feel No Fear. This is Fresh Air. It's the first day of the Whitewater hearings. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what we have on that on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. The hearings get underway before the House Banking Committee. Lloyd Cutler, a White House counsel, is telling the committee he has noted regrettable contacts between the White House and the Treasury Department, but he says he found no evidence of cover-ups. Other stories, the Bosnian Serbs are shutting the main supply route into Sarajevo because they say the Bosnian government has been smuggling in weapons. Mark Doyle reports from Kigali, the capital of Rwanda, on the new Rwandan government. Also, Melissa Block with stories from the Central Park Carousel in New York City.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Commentator Dagoberto Gilb and his son are heading to Arkansas this week for the Little League Regional Championships. They live in El Paso. Dagoberto says he's glad the regular season is coming to a close.
My youngest son Ricardo began this baseball season really excited because last year his team, the Blazers, won the City World Series. He had the dream come true year. During the playoffs, he scored the winning run that took them to the championship. His slide into home, coming like it did at the bottom of the last inning, made the front page of the sports section, in color no less. If that weren't enough, the very next game, the first of a best-of-five series, was against the Cobras, a team so dominating they hadn't lost a single game yet. Ricardo came up with the bases loaded, and at the top of their ninth, drove a pitch so hard that when it hit the chicken wire above the left field fence, the ball rode up. At the bottom of that inning, pitching, he struck out two, and the Cobras scored nothing. After this, the series was history. But you and I both know it wasn't my son. It wasn't just the other good players on the team either. It was the coach, Junior. The kids loved him, and he knew what he was doing. Junior was a star high school athlete. He was around 30, divorced with two daughters, one 12. If anything, Junior put in too much time with the boys on the team. That's because he didn't have a job, unless you counted his occasional weekend gigs when he dressed up as a mariachi. He also took a couple of classes at the community college. But mostly he was unemployed. What he wished for was a job with Parks because he loved sports so much. He coached basketball as good as he did baseball. But Junior couldn't coach this year because he was in hiding. The kids on every team sell candy, and Junior didn't turn the money in for three different teams, like $1,600. He'd been having personal problems. I knew his truck had been stolen. So this season began without Junior, and without baseballs, bats, helmets, catcher's equipment, practice bases, and uniforms. And the champion Blazers were starting over again. The new coach doesn't have a telephone. The new coach works for maybe a dollar more than minimum wage, where the nuts you eat on airplanes are packaged. He works strange hours, and so there haven't been many practices. When there are, there aren't much. Mostly he yells at the kids, frustrated, for making mistakes. They don't like him. He has eight all-star level players, Carlos and Freddie, Raul, Roger, Adrian and David and Bobby, and my son Ricardo. But they're looking at a 500 record. The only other team with equal talent in our league, the one that has the newest, coolest uniforms and the top-of-the-line equipment, is a team which has something else, too. The same coach, the same coaches they've had for several years. They get into the playoffs almost every season. In the neighborhood where the Blazers practice, walls are for graffiti fights. Most of the players live in modest, even unattractive homes on wider streets that people drive past on their way to work. Their parents graduated high school. One is going to a business college to become a medical secretary, while another just got a job as a clerk at the prison where her husband works. Several are single parents. These are the only ones who attend the games. All speak Spanish, and several only Spanish. There are other children, if they are just out of high school, are married, or about to be. But nobody talks about college to the younger ones either. Poverty is often seen for its brutality, for what it absolutely denies. But common poverty isn't about not getting started. It's as much about only getting started, about always being at the beginning. Poverty is about starting over yet again and then again. It's about talent fully shaped, but which, unencouraged, discouraged, lasts the briefest moment. The Blazers aren't talking about baseball anymore. The parents say how next year, if their son wants to play, they'll find some other team. I want to let you in on a secret the commissioner of our league just told me not to tell anyone else. Our new coach hasn't turned in his candy money either. Over $500. The coach's wife had it in her purse at a grocery store, and then it was gone. Lost, stolen, something like that, the commissioner told me, and he shook his head.
Dagoberto Gilb is the author of The Magic of Blood, which won this year's Penn Hemingway Foundation Award. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Sue Spolin, Jewel Bracey, and Kathy Wolf. Research assistance from Mark Tullis. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Civil wars have torn apart Bosnia, Rwanda, and Somalia. Shelby Foote says civil wars are often the most savage ones. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Foote about the civil war that tore apart the United States. Foote was the principal commentator on the PBS series The Civil War. His new book is about the Gettysburg Campaign. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.